Hello, listeners. Welcome to Film Club episode 20. We are back once again, chopping up a brand new film. Well, it's not technically brand new, but it is brand new in our catalogue. You know what I'm saying. My name is Mal Foster, as always, joined by my wonderful co-host and co-pilot, Mr. Dan Seraph. How are you doing, sir?
I'm great, thank you. How are you, Mal?
I'm doing pretty good. I'm pretty good. Pretty excited for this episode, I must admit. We are, of course, if you haven't listened to the last episode, talking about this week, Chinatown, which was Dan's pick from 2 weeks ago. So, in that sense, I'm going to hand it over to Dan real quick to kind of just tee up the film and give a little explanation as to why he picked Chinatown for our 19th entry, I believe this is now.
Well, we've had a couple of obscure picks over the last couple of weeks, Matt. I'm sure you'll agree with me with that.
Oh,
And I
yeah.
like that. I like that. I like that about Film Club. Hopefully we've introduced some people to films that maybe they hadn't heard of before, maybe they had heard but hadn't seen before. So this time around, I wanted to switch things up and just choose a bona fide classic of a film. And that, to me, is Chinatown. Chinatown, for those of you who have maybe just watched it and don't really know some of the background of it. It's a film that came out in 1974, directed by Roman Polanski, kind of at the height of Roman Polanski's fame, I guess, starring Jack Nicholson, Faye Dunaway, and John Huston. And it's essentially kind of a what would have been in 1970s a modern take on the film noir genre, a genre that hadn't, I suppose, been touched on for quite a while. And Roman Polanski kind of takes it and switches it up a bit and adds some interesting and cynical and new elements to the genre that you probably perhaps didn't see back in the 50s or 40s. But more than anything else, it's just an incredible piece of storytelling that, for my mind, is some of the best storytelling that I've seen in cinema. The script by Robert Towne is just incredible. You know, the actual performing of the story by the three principal cast members is incredible. This is Roman Polanski at his best, and I just think that all elements of this film across the board are just totally superb. I absolutely love this film.
This is the second time I've seen it. I've seen it a couple of years ago, so I have seen it prior to coming into it. But you know what? It's weird because I'd actually forgotten quite a lot about it, and kind of found myself sucked into it as if I was watching it again for the first time. And that in part I think is down to Robert Towne's script because it is really deeply layered. I mean, the film kind of goes at a slow burning pace. But there's so many kind of unraveling layers, and it kind of takes little twists and turns, and it goes deeper, and it peels one section off, and some things aren't quite exactly how you think they are, and it's a real testament to the actual writing of the film. The fact that having seen it, I was actually surprised by certain elements of what happened in the film.
Yeah, it's a film that you can go back to time and time again and still enjoy because I think it's because it's such a complex film. Not in a way that it's overbearing and you end up feeling confused and stuck and frustrated, but because there are so many, like you said, layers to the film. And there are so many kind of red herrings here and there and things that are, you know, mysteries that don't unravel until later on in the film. And there are so many kind of little jigsaw pieces that you have to put together in Chinatown to kind of give you this full picture that you can go back time and time again and forget, you know, this certain subplot which added to this, which added to that. And I think that's one of the great things about Chinatown, the fact that, you know, it is a film that, I mean, I've seen it a number of times now, and I can still come back to it and think, oh God, I forgot this element of the story entirely. There are things that still stick in my mind, but there are little nuts and bolts of the plot which you just forget, and it just draws you back in every time and still makes it fascinating on however many views you've seen it.
I mean, we should. So we usually we do interject this point before we actually start talking about it. But if you haven't yet seen Chinatown, you know, you might want to stop now, go watch it, and then come back because there will be spoilerish stuff, especially with the next point I'm going to make, which is something that I did completely forget about. So fair warning, right now, if you haven't seen it yet, or if you're like halfway through it and you're listening to it, then you really kind of want to go and finish it off before coming back into this. So if everyone's seen it, we'll carry on with spoilers abound. One bit that really kind of threw me was the mother, daughter, mother, daughter. Oh, no, sorry. Daughter, sister, bit near the sort of latter end of the film in which Faye Dunaway's character reveals the true sort of nature between the relationship of her and her husband's alleged mistress. I mean, it is a very strange and weird and complex plot, but not, like you said, it's not overbearing. It's just very layered, and there's so many strings that lead from one point to another. But when that hit, I had completely forgotten about that, and I literally said out loud, "Oh shit." Because it kind of threw me, and that's what it does. It's in a sense, it's kind of like a magician, the film, because it does have a lot of red herrings, and it does kind of do a lot of sort of sleight of hand with its storytelling. You know, it kind of leads you to think one thing, and then it kind of reveals something that has been there all along. And it's very kind of is extremely clever, and it is a real testament to the writing, but it's also a real testament to the way the film's directed, I think, that it manages to do that. But the whole sister daughter thing, it just literally threw me, and I was like, oh wow, okay, that was quite shocking, even though I knew that in the back of my head, and I'd just been reminded of it. So
Yeah, I mean, it's a dark film. Like,
oh yeah.
it's probably, I mean, I know Roman Polanski is known for his horror films, and which are, of course, like inherently dark being horror films, but this is especially dark. And I guess people, when they first saw it for the first time in the 70s, probably would have been surprised by the fact that Roman Polanski was making this kind of, film noir genre piece. But it is kind of indebted to horror in so many ways because you have such kind of twisted themes at the center of it. But I think Roman Polanski captures it so well as well, because you have, I mean, on the surface, it's a very pretty, beautiful looking film. You know, it's full of these kind of gorgeous landscapes and palm trees and sunsets. But then slowly over the course of the film, he kind of peels that back and just reveals this really kind of dark undertone of corruption and incest and murder, all just kind of lying under the surface. And I mean, I spoke last week about how I kind of feel that this film is very much influenced by things that happened in Roman Polanski's life. I mean, 5 years before this film was when the Manson family murdered his wife and unborn child. And of course, he kind of came to Hollywood with these kind of dreams and, kind of in kind of believing in the American dream, I suppose, and then saw just this kind of real dark, horrible side to it that was just unbearable for him. And I kind of feel like that is such a major theme in Chinatown, that contrast between, the kind of glorious, kind of beautiful LA and this kind of idyllic America, and then the really dark, horrible stuff that happens under the surface.
Oh yeah, well, I mean, that's part for me. That's definitely one of the aspects that make it such an engaging and interesting film, is that you do have this setting where you have sort of the golden age of Hollywood, and like you say, the actual look of the film is really kind of crisp and clear and beautiful, and yet you have all these kind of murky layers kind of lying underneath, and it's just this wonderful, wonderful sort of juxtaposition. It's a weird kind of comparison to draw to, but watching it again and seeing those two sort of opposing sides, it made me think of like the opening to David Lynch's Blue Velvet, where you see like the beautiful, picturesque sort of suburban neighborhood, and then you dig beneath the dirt. Now it's a bit more subtle, and it's not quite as visually sort of probing as that particular example, but it kind of does that balance really, really well within this film. And I think that definitely there is some influence rubbed off from Polanski's personal life into the story as a whole, but also into the character of Jake, I think, as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, one of the things I kind of feel is Roman Polanski's brought to it as well is this kind of subtle hint at kind of, I suppose, a hatred towards minorities in the film. And of course, Roman Polanski's, I think it was maybe grandparents or maybe it was parents were killed in the Holocaust. And you kind of have these undertones of, like, I'm trying to remember the specific scene. I think it's when they go to the old folks' home and the owner of the basically says, oh, we don't accept people of the Jewish faith. And then there's also kind of a hint that people in Chinatown, I suppose Asian people in Chinatown, are being arrested and charged with crimes that they haven't committed. And so you kind of have this very subtle hint towards the way that, America and I suppose maybe not just America, but the way society kind of treats people that are on the kind of margins or fringes or minorities in society, which I do think is something that Roman Polanski's kind of brought to this based on his own personal experiences.
Absolutely. I mean, you do, when you watch the film, you do kind of get a lot of the echoes of stuff that perhaps he or people that in directly or indirectly have been linked with. You kind of get essences of his personal life and his sort of story, as it were, into it. I mean, even the darker aspects, and even the fact that, you know, it's touched on that Faye Dunaway's character was raped by her father, you know. Not to kind of dig too deep into that Polanski-shaped hole, but there is an essence of even that dark side to his history, kind of somewhat present within the film, and it's interesting to see how that kind of has worked its way in several ways.
I think one of the things that really just astounds me about the film more than anything else, though, is the fact that it really kind of, I mean, the film noir genre, which obviously I think Chinatown is pretty much kind of embedded in, that's kind of a genre that primarily has been one where the good guy always wins. And I mean, we've talked about some of the darker themes, as you mentioned, you know, Faye Dunaway's character being raped by her father. And he, like, in the classic film noir films, you know, the hero would kind of save the day and get the girl. Everything would be, you know, safe and everything would be fine. Everything would come to this like happy resolution of sorts, or at least justice would be served. But here, that is definitely not the case. Here, basically, corruption and evil and the bad guys win. And I think more than anything else, that is the most shocking element of the film for me, especially, of course, the ending. When Faye Dunaway's character is shot and Jake Gittes is basically told, forget it. Like, well, I mean, the line is, forget it, Jake, it's Chinatown, which is essentially, you know, like, you can't win. It's like, it's done. Like, the bad guys have won here. And I think that's just like such an antithesis to the film noir genre. It's such an antithesis to film, like, to American cinema. And it just blows me away that Roman Polanski had the audacity to pull that off. And it does pull it off as well. It's an incredible scene.
Oh yeah, well, it's such a fantastic ending, you know. I mean, it's as far as I know, that wasn't the originally intended scene, but I think Polanski changed it to fit with sort of the bleaker tones throughout the film. And to be honest, it works, and I can't really imagine the film ending on any other note, because it just kind of slots into it so well. And in a sense, for that kind of genre, like you say, in film noir of the past before this, there was a lot of straight divisions. You know, the good guys were good. Maybe they kind of did things, perhaps that leaned against the rules. But you know, their moral compass was aligned with the good, and the bad with the bad. And you know, the good guys won, got the girl example, like you said before. But with this, there's much more sort of an ambivalence, and there's more ambiguity to it. You know, it's not clear. It's not black and white. It's very murky. Both sides kind of cross over, and with that particular ending, it is a bit of a downer, but it works so incredibly well with the tone and the way that the film sort of plays out from start to finish.
Yeah, it's a huge downer. It's a huge downer film. It is a really depressing ending. I mean, especially so because Noah Cross is such a horrible, hateful character. And he's incredibly performed by John Huston. Like, I think for me, that's one of the best screen performances I've seen. But I think it also just helps the fact that he isn't this kind of, you know, cackling, you know, cliche villain. I mean, he's creepy, he's really kind of lizard-like, but he's a very realistic villain, I guess, in the sense that he's driven by power and influence and money, as opposed to some kind of, you know, comic fantastical kind of desire to rule the world or whatever. In a way, I suppose, I guess he does. He doesn't want to destroy the world, I guess, but he wants to control his environment. And I mean, his treatment of Faye Dunaway's character Evelyn and Catherine is sort of an extension of that, you know, the way he kind of exploits the world around him for his own gain, be it on a kind of business level or personal kind of sexual level. And so he's just this horrible character. And so the fact that he wins at the end of this film, essentially, and he gets off, you know, with murder on, I mean, he gets off with the initial murder, and essentially, you know, Evelyn's murder is overlooked. And he isn't seen as the real criminal, which he is. I mean, it's just a crazy, depressing ending, but like you said, it works so well.
It does, and I mean, it's a really interesting point that you bring out with his character, because he you know, he is, like, to kind of contradict what I said, he's clearly defined as a bad guy, but he gets away with it, essentially, because he learns how to play the system. He knows the strings to pull, he knows how to merge in the background, he knows basically how to kind of filter himself down. He is horrible, he is skeezy, he is just a horrible, horrible man, but yet he knows how to blemish himself in with the sort of greys of the background, and he knows how to kind of work himself in with the right departments, and it's a sense that everything kind of bleeds and blends into one another. And granted, you know, so his character is more aligned to the bad side, and obviously Jake's is more aligned to the good, but it's not like a straight definition. There's more complex layering to the characters. And I think Jake himself is a very interesting character, because he is obviously the guy that you're supposed to be behind, but yet he has a strange sense of humour, which is very funny, and I'll get to in a moment. But he is... He's more defined. He's not just a straight up good guy. He smacks Evelyn about a bit in one scene, and it's like, you are such a horrible man. But at the same time, you're kind of like, well, you're supposed to be the person that I'm kind of rooting for. But at the same time, I see that you are kind of murky yourself, and that you, as much as you don't want to admit it, and as much as perhaps you don't think it, you have actually been kind of tainted somewhat by the way that Hollywood is.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think one of the most interesting aspects of Jake's character is that he's not the typical hero in the sense that, you know, he is the one who kind of puts all the pieces together and figures out what's going on. And of course, we've already said that he doesn't put a stop to it. But usually the hero is the one who kind of, mm-hmm. you know, figures it all out. And in the case of Chinatown, Jake tends to be wrong.
Yeah,
more often than he is right. He misses, like, important information. He doesn't put together the pieces correctly. I mean, he's not stupid, he's not naive. He's just in over his head. And I think, again, that is one of the major themes of Chinatown, the fact that Jake is just kind of... He essentially sets out on this, what he thinks is a very small case that he can handle, which is just this adultery case, to take photos of someone that has been accused of seeing someone else. That's it. And so when he's kind of drawn into this big world of this incredibly complex water scandal, and, you know, there are businesses and water departments all kind of invested in what's happening, he's over his head, and he can't put it all together and stop it from happening. And thus, you know, the bad guys succeed. And I think that's a really interesting aspect of his character. Like you said, there, he isn't the kind of clean-cut kind of American hero. There are kind of darker sides to him, there are murky sides to him, and he's not a hero in the sense that, you know, he's not a great detective. He's just kind of caught in the middle of this.
He's no Batman.
No.
or Miss Marple, or whichever, or maybe a mix of the two. No, I like that about him, because, you know, you do get the sense that the further the case goes on, the more he's up against, and the more he's kind of almost like he's kind of trying to catch up, almost. It's almost as if the whole thing is way ahead of him, and he's doing his best to sort of catch up and try and keep up with what's going on. But, you know, again, and it helps kind of establish him as more down to earth, I guess, in that sense. One thing I really liked about the actual directing of the film is, and I don't know if you've noticed this, but a lot of the camera placements and a lot of the shots are kind of either just behind Jake or by the side of him. And at points it kind of feels like you're actually in the story trying to solve the case yourself, almost.
Yeah.
Which,
yeah,
I thought
totally.
Was...
I mean, it's very voyeuristic. Like, that's the way it kind of seems to me.
I really like that, and I can't remember picking up on that the first time I watched it, but this time around I was like, this actually seems quite deliberate, and it really was kind of effective. It's almost as if you are a silent partner on this case, almost. In that sense, I actually really kind of enjoyed the film from a different aspect, because you're not so much just kind of watching in a passive manner, you're actually watching as things unfold, as twists occur and things happen, and you kind of feel almost more involved with the storyline.
Oh yeah, totally. I like this thing that a lot of the time he's kind of hidden behind windows and perched just over the walls. And actually, I remember the scene in which it's very early on when he's following Hollis Mulray, I think that's how you say his name,
mm-hmm.
and he kind of ducks to just get out of his like line of sight, and the camera kind of ducks as well.
Yeah.
It really does kind of put you in that kind of first person's perspective of Jake Gitt. It's not, you know, actually in the first person perspective. Yeah. You are kind of following him, and it is very much in his shoes. And you know, going back to what we were saying before, you know, like that character is always a step behind, and in a way the kind of screenplay always keeps you as a viewer a step behind. Mm-hmm. It's hard for you to kind of put together the pieces until Jake puts together the pieces, A, because it's so complex, but B, I think it's also a very kind of fundamental structuring decision by Robert Town to kind of, you know, keep a lot of things kind of murky and ambiguous, and so as Jake kind of figures them out, you do too. Unfortunately, you're just like a step behind across, and you're unable to stop it. And I think it does kind of put you on the ground, and I think Jake Gittes as a character is supposed to represent, you know, the viewer, or at least like the general public of people. And yeah, it just kind of give you this emotional attachment to him and the story. And I think it works incredibly well. I think it's such a great creative decision by Roman Polanski.
For me, I think there's many components which make this such a great film. We've talked about the writing, we've talked about Nicholson's performance, which is, I mean, it's not one that often, you know, he gets lumped in with his best performances being The Shining, etc., which, you know, are fantastic, and of course, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, but this is definitely one of his best performances as well. It just doesn't tend to get mentioned as much. But for me, one of the real sort of key points to why Chinatown works so well is actually Faye Dunaway, because she's fantastic in the film, and she really kind of helps to sort of perpetuate the sense of you kind of being one step behind, because she is kind of really frosty and cold at one point. Well, for most of the film, to be honest, she's very guarded, and she does a lot of the misdirection, and she is kind of like a corner point in which the plot kind of revolves around, because she is a connection to so many different points in it, and yet she has this kind of veil of sort of ambiguity that kind of helps keep her a stiff arm between her and Jake and you and the plot and the truth. And she's very much kind of like a center sort of point in which so much revolves around, and there's a lot of pressure obviously in that role, but she does incredibly well to kind of keep things on an even keel and cool, and there's a real sort of mysterious charm about her. You want to get to know more about her, you get to know, want to know what it is that she's got herself involved with, who she is, what's happened to her, but yet she does it on her own time, and she kind of reels you in gradually. And I think that is definitely, for me at least, one of the major sort of catalysts for why Chinatown is so good.
I couldn't have said that any better. I think one of the things that I love about Faye Dunaway's performance, I have not really noticed it until this time. I mean, I've always loved the way that she's kind of delivered her dialogue and her lines, and I've never quite figured out why it is. It's always been so fascinating to me. But I think the reason why is because it always comes across intentionally very well rehearsed. Mm-hmm. Like, she's got so many secrets, and she's got to kind of internally process every word that she, like, before it comes out of her mouth. Everything's very kind of meticulous with her, and it just makes her like such a standout character in the sense that she's not like anyone else in that cast, and you are drawn into her world and her universe. And she is kind of, I think, as much as Noah Cross is an incredible character in the sense that he's so kind of slimy and villainy, and I love Jack Nicholson in the film and I think he's a great character, I think Faye Dunaway really is that kind of central focus point in the film, because she is the character that you really are intrigued by and fascinated by, and you just want to kind of unravel her and her secrets and what she knows and what she doesn't know and how she's involved in all this, because she kind of knows everything in a way.
Yeah.
And it's kind of, it's all there, and you just kind of, you want to get out of her, and she is awesome in the film. She's absolutely incredible.
She's playing very much the ultimate poker face, because like you said, she knows everything, you know, she knows the truth, and she could give away absolutely anything at any point. So, you know, you kind of are watching a very cognitive performance, in the sense that she is like thinking and thinking over again and thinking over three times exactly what she's saying, how she's saying it, you know what I mean? Because if she slips up just one thing, that could break open a particular crack, which leads into a certain lead. And it's just a fascinating performance to watch. And it's kind of mesmerizing in a sense, you know, it really kind of keeps your attention, and you watch her, and it's just, it just, to me, it's just extremely fascinating how she manages to do it, because, you know, in the hands of anybody else, it could have kind of just really either been really stiff and really boring, or it could have just all fallen apart. It's like a really sort of tightly wound performance, and it just comes across fantastically.
Yeah, that's a great thing. I mean, she's not stoic all the time. Like, no. She just kind of gives it away just enough. Like, you just sort of see the cracks kind of breaking and seeing what's under the surface ever so slightly throughout the film, until towards the end with that iconic, you know, she's my sister, she's my daughter, she's my sister, she's my daughter scene. When, you know, when she really just kind of explodes and everything that she's been keeping secret kind of really comes out. But you see it throughout the film as well, you know, like, there's a scene where Jake Gittes is driving off and she just kind of lets out this quick expletive of just like, Jake, and then suddenly kind of closes her mouth tight shut again. Her lips are sealed. And you know all along that she's got something secret that she's hiding about, but then she's not, you know, completely closed off. It's incredible work by Faye Dunaway. And I don't know if she won an Oscar for it. I'm sure she was nominated for it.
No, I don't think she was nominated.
She was definitely nominated. I'm just looking on IMDb now, but she didn't win, which is a travesty because I think she's. I think it's just one of the greatest performances in a film with so many great performances. I think she stands out.
That's the thing, in a film where it is literally every performance is pretty much stand out and exceptional in different ways. You know, it's hard to kind of put yourself out across as a key piece, but she does incredibly well. What's interesting is, I mean, the film is very bleak and it's very dark and it's complex and it's dramatic and it is actually very gripping in places, but it's also very funny in places as well.
Yeah,
like there's a wonderful sort of sense of humour, and it's kind of established really early on. And I mean, the film is full of quotes, like full of really kind of memorable quotes. But for me, one of my favorites, and it happens right at the start, and it was one that I just had to make a note for. It was the first case you see sort of Jake working on, and it's with Curly when he finds out his wife's been having an affair, and he's basically Curly, played by the guy that plays Paulie in Rocky, I think it is.
Yeah, it is, yeah.
And he's moaning at the window, and there's just this wonderful, really whip smart line. And again, it's another testament to Towne's writing, particularly in the dialogue, which is fantastic in the film all the way throughout. But the line, you know, enough's enough, you can't eat the Venetian blinds, I just had them installed on Wednesday. I think that's just a fantastic line. And I mean, it could have been, again, with a different performer taking the role of Jake, that's the kind of line that could have just been a totally throwaway line. But it's kind of the vitriolic way in which Nicholson just kind of fires it out in his way, that kind of smarmy, almost tongue-in-cheek manner, that it just really works, and it helps establish a more human side to the grizzled aspects of Jake. But I think the film is very funny in certain places, which is nice, you know, because tonally it's a nice relief to have that. And there's that crazy joke about the Chinaman screwing, and you know, it's just totally weird. But, you know, it helps kind of lift the tone of the film, I think, in places, which is good because it needs it in certain places.
Yeah, I mean, like we said, it's a very, very dark film, at least in a thematical sense. And I think the fact that, you know, the script does inject kind of more human, humorous moments, I think, in a sense, it just kind of grounds it, you know. I think it does kind of place it a lot more in kind of a realistic reality that you can all relate to, but it also does provide a little bit of relief from just how depressing it is. But I mean, like you said, it is full of great quotes, that film. I mean, one of the ones that I've actually made a note of, because it always stands out to me in a very dramatic sense, it's not funny at all. In fact, it's very much the opposite. It always really hits me when I hear this line. It's when Noah Cross says something to the effect of, like, most people never have to face the fact that at the right time, at the right place, they're capable of doing anything. And I think that's just such a kind of dark kind of line.
That's a real, especially when delivered by John of sorts.
I mean, I kind of feel like Noah Cross is kind of speaking bullshit in a way there, because I kind of just feel like, you know, it's not a right place and a right time for him. He's kind of so institutionalized in the way that he kind of is, so everything that he does is criminal in a way. I think he's just kind of, that is just kind of a normal behavior for him. But at the same time, like, I kind of feel like, you know, that is a very hard-hitting line, the fact that, you know, nobody kind of, in the film, there is no kind of clear-cut, like you said, good guy or bad guy. It's people who have just kind of made this conscious decision at some point in their lives to kind of do something criminal, be it kind of extorting money or, you know, committing this scandal that's leaving people poor and impoverished and bankrupt or, you know, or anything. I think it's just such a hard-hitting line.
I think that's a really good line. I hadn't actually noted that, but that's a fantastic line, especially coming from the character of Noah Cross, who, as you say, that really doesn't apply to him, but it's almost like a sort of rationalisation on his half. Almost, you know, what's... So there we go. Slight interruption in the programming there, Skype being temperamental as always, but hopefully it won't have interrupted your enjoyment too much, but... There you go, that was Chinatown. Unless you've got anything else you want to throw in to add that I'm missing?
Not particularly. It's a great film, so I hope that everybody's enjoyed watching it again. I think it's just, like we've said, I mean, it's a film that has so many great elements of the storytelling, you know, the performances, the direction is fantastic. But I also think there's so much that you can take away from the film if you kind of watch it again and look under the surface for things. Far too much that we could ever even get through in half an hour, 40 minutes. I mean, there's so much about corruption and the way, you know, the kind of rich, big folk kind of look down and push around the little folk in terms of kind of for financial gain and for power and for money. And, you know, there's so much about America and capitalism all kind of seen through this very pessimistic, cynical perspective of Roman Polanski. It's just such a great film. So I hope it was a good choice and I hope everybody liked it.
Oh, absolutely. Well, I can only speak for myself, but I can definitely say it was a good choice, and it was excellent to view it again. And hopefully, the listeners agree as well, especially if they've never seen it before.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. Okay, so that leaves us to my pick. And the last film that I picked, if you remember, was Beauty and the Beast, which was somewhat of a left field choice for me and somewhat abstract and unusual. But I kind of am getting things back on track. And when you hear what this week's film pick from me will be, you'll kind of be like, and we're back. That makes sense.
Brilliant.
Something, and it's something I've tried to get into with a current trend that we're seeing in cinema at the minute. For some reason, and I don't know why, but fairy tales and the sense of fantasy and the supernatural and magic are very much kind of like a big hot ticket for movie studios recently. Last year we had two reworkings of Snow White. We've had recently Hansel and Gretel, which obviously was a Brothers Grimm tale, turned into what, I haven't seen it, but it looks like an absolute abomination. you've had recently, we had Red Riding Hood a couple of years ago, which I think you saw and hated, didn't you?
Yeah, I couldn't stand it, it was awful.
So yeah, it seems as if... like Hollywood's on this thing at the moment where it's like, okay, so let's take a fairy tale, let's make it dark, let's try and gear it more towards older tweens, teens and adults, let's make it a little bit, you know, ooh and ah. And to be honest, it's all kind of failed. It really hasn't managed to do anything it's set out to from what I've seen, from what I've heard. However, this does. This is very much a fairy tale, an original story fairy tale, made essentially for adults, but also for the inner child within adults. It was made in 2006 by a wonderful Spanish visionary by the name of, I'm going to attempt to pronounce his name, Guillermo del Toro. And the film I'm talking about is Pan's Labyrinth.
Great choice.
Mm-hmm. I just thought, you know, it seems to be this thing that's going about at the minute. Let's take fairy tales, try and make them dark, try and make them edgy. And it's just not worked. And then I was thinking, has it ever? And then I was like, of course it has. Pan's Labyrinth did it so fantastically well. And it's been a long time since I've seen it. So for those who haven't seen it, it is, as I said, written and directed by, and I'm going to attempt their name again. Is it?
I think you got it right. I think you got it absolutely spot on.
Guillermo del Toro.
Yeah.
And it's set in the midst of the Spanish Civil War, and it's about a young lady named Pan, who is forced to live with her mother and her stepfather, who is a high-ranking official within the Spanish army, I believe. And she is basically trapped in the wilderness of the countryside in a life that she has no choice but to kind of exist in until she finds the labyrinth in the title of the film, in which many magical and weird and wonderful and horrifically dark things happen to her. And she goes on a very sort of astounding journey of sorts. So I just kind of thought that's pretty timely, and we'll go with that. So there you go.
Absolutely. That's a great choice.
Thank you. You've seen it before, yes?
I have. Actually, I have a very nostalgic kind of affinity for this film because it's one of the first films that I really, really fell in love with.
Oh,
This is basically one of the first times I was kind of like, shit, this is how good cinema can be. And
wow.
I really kind of got into doing essentially kind of what I do now. So, I mean, I do have a very, nostalgic love for this film, but it's an incredible film. I think you put it brilliantly. It's a great dark adult fairy tale. It's also kind of about fairy tales as well, and the effect that it can have on someone. It's awesome. I'm so excited to watch it again because it's been ages since I saw it.
Same here, which is part of the reason why I picked it, because it's been far too long. So there you go. If you haven't seen it before, you are in for a treat. And if you have, well, you're in for a treat as well, but one that you've already fortunately bore witness to. So there you go. 2006 Pan's Labyrinth, your next pick for Film Club. So you've got 2 weeks to go seek it out and watch it, and then let us know what you think. You can get in touch with us as usual via the usual places at twitter.com/invasionradio, or if you head on over to Facebook, you can find Screen Invasion, and you can find Film Club forums over on Facebook as well. And I believe we have an email account, which I haven't checked for a couple of weeks, but I will for next show, which is filmclub@gmx.com. So if you want to let us know what you think of Pan's Labyrinth or Chinatown, or perhaps you're just making your way through the collection of films that we've already put into it, let us know what you think. If you are catching up with it and you want to go back and see what else we reviewed, I will, like I said last time, and like I did last time, I will put the link to the little letterboxed collection of films, which you can view, and you can see every entry that we have put into Film Club since its inception last year.
Nice.
Yeah, so there we go. Being organized for once kind of works. I see the merits of it now. So there you go. Pan's Labyrinth, 2 weeks' time. Been wonderful talking Chinatown with you, Dan.
Awesome. Thank you. It's been good talking to you too.
Awesome, and hopefully you've enjoyed it. And if you haven't, don't worry. You know, there'll be plenty more for you to try and see if you like those as well. But until next time, go watch Pan's Labyrinth and let us know what you think of it via those mediums I just talked about just then. Until then, we'll see you next time. Olé, which is Spanish for hello, not goodbye. What is Spanish for
I see
good?
what you did there. I have no
Yeah.
idea.
El
I don't
good, el
know.
good, el goodbye.
I don't know. I was gonna say gracias, but that's thank you, isn't it? What is Spanish for goodbye? I'm googling this shit. Spanish goodbye.
Adios.
Oh yeah. That
Adios.
makes sense. That make a lot of sense.
That would. There you go. Adios. Oh dear.